That's for people here.
And on our chat.
They sign into? Good afternoon. Welcome to the first Faculty Senate meeting of this academic year. I'm Senate Speaker Jonathan Oxhorn, Emeritus Professor. We'll start with the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. If you're in person, don't forget to sign in. And if you're in Zoom land, also sign in, I believe, through the chat function. So the meeting is called to order. Our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from May 10th, 2023. The minutes have been posted and distributed online in the form of a verbatim transcript, so there are usually no substantive corrections. If there are any, please let me know. Hearing none, the minutes are approved and posted as posted. Our first order of business after the approval of minutes is the Senate announcements and updates. Eve DeRosa, Dean of Faculty, and Chelsea Sprecht, Associate Dean of Faculty. Starting with Eve.
Okay, next slide, please. So first, it's nice to see people in person, and so welcome to you and those of you online. And I wanted to sort of welcome our new senators who were in the faculty orientation 2 weeks ago, and so hopefully you feel ready to engage and contribute in our discussions, and then welcome back to our previous senators, and of course, any faculty who are here online or in person. I do write Senate summaries, and I try to be as concise as I can to summarize what we speak about in Senate meetings, and I try to get those out on Friday. My hope is that you either forward that to your faculty on a listserv or to the administrator and of your unit, and they forward it. For our RTE faculty, you will be getting a list of your constituents, and so we'll be sending you that as well. And then I'm going to let Chelsea sort of speak about the work that she's been doing to really make a robust nominations and elections procedure. So.
Thanks, Eve. I just want to be really brief. The Nominations and Elections Committee has had our first meeting and sort of gone over what our charge is going to be for the coming year, spaces that are available on the various committees that that we find nominees for. I just want to put a plug in that now is your time if you'd like to self-nominate or if you're find anybody that you know that you think would be an excellent member of one of our committees, now's your chance. Otherwise, all the slots will be filled by the Nominations and Elections Committee. So if you have names you'd like to present, please come forward with yourself or other members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chelsea. And this mosaic, we've been creating them every year. I think we have everybody in there. Five departments were a little late, so we'll be sending a physical poster that you can put outside your office so that you're identified as your unit's senator, representative of the faculty voice, and then your faculty can come speak to you about topics that we're engaged in, but also new topics that we should engage in. So I hope that you'll do that. Okay, next slide, please. This is a slide that I show for the Board of Trustees presentation that I do at the end of the year as a way to represent the work of the Faculty Senate and the Office of the Dean of Faculty. I loved making this because it really communicates to them how much faculty engage in the well-being of the institution as volunteers, above and beyond what we're contracted to do. And so we're making meaningful contributions, not just to the academic policies and procedures, but also culture. You'll see there's music, the university lectures, the professors at large, ROTC. And so we as faculty are contributing to all of those elements on campus. And I'm very thankful. I see some excellent work happening on the Senate committees, and people are very conscientious and thoughtful and careful. So it's great. Okay, and next slide, please. Oh, and I put little hyperlinks for the new faculty so that the acronyms aren't overwhelming. I remember first hearing all the acronyms, and so you can click on it and find out what the work of that committee is if you need it. These are all the new faculty members who are going to be contributing to Senate committees. We have our 135 of us here, and then we also have all the work that's happening on the committees, and they feed forward to the Senate. Next slide, please. Samples of the work that we're doing. So this academic year, guaranteed, you'll be hearing about these topics. And so that's the academic freedom and professional status of faculty. And so they'll be thinking about the fact that we just had the business school move, harmonize their tenure clock across all three schools that feed into this College of Business. And they move from a mixed of 6 and 8 year tenure clock to all being on an 8 year tenure clock. That's the standard for their profession. Well, it turns out that also for AAP, their peer institutions are having a longer tenure clock as well. And so that's a conversation that will come to the Senate. They are also looking at how to value collaborative science and translational science. We're finding that a lot of early career scholars are having to, in order to get funding, are having to build teams and do collaborative work. But then how do we value the parts of expertise that they bring to the collaboration, and how does it get reflected and valued in tenure? So that's another conversation on that team. And I'm going to bring a request from the president to that committee to how do we elevate faculty? How do we get faculty to have more honorific awards to show the excellence of what people are doing on this campus? And so we're going to start with a conversation, and we'll decide how to build a robust sort of process and structure so that this can happen across campus-wide. There are certain colleges that are doing an excellent job in building that culture, but we really want that to be a university-wide process. We are going to actually start to hear today a conversation about bringing teaching professor titles potentially to Cornell, and the pros, the cons. Is it something that sits independent of lecturer, senior lecturer, or does it subsume that those titles? And so we're going to start the conversation today, and we'll continue it until we come to some resolution. The Education Policy Committee, what's really important, there was a mental health review in 1995, I believe, a while ago. Maybe it was 2005, that seems too far away. So the mental health review happened. I won't say that a year because I think I just really butchered that. And what they learned was that there were certain places that there was just amped up student anxiety. And so the Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education put together many faculty groups with like 20 faculty to deal with particular issues. And so some of those have already started to come to the Senate. We made a custom system-wide honor system that came through the Senate, and we approved. And so this year there'll be other policies like that. And one of them is the idea of capping the first semester experience and capping the number of credits that students can take in that very, very first semester when they're transitioning. The swim competency test, note that it's not the swim test, and I think it might not, so there has been a lot of work by the Athletics and Physical Ed Senate Committee, and they've brought in experts and read many papers. And so they have drafted a resolution, and we're going to share that with different student groups across campus before bringing it to the Senate, but it will ultimately come here with feedback from many different constituents. Reapportionment, nominations, elections. So every 3 years, it's our job to make sure that we have real representation in, and in light of a lot of structural changes, there will be significant sort of changes in how we want to make sure that Brooks is represented, these multi-college units are represented by the Senate, and make sure that it's equitable. And then our university ROTC Relations Committee, they are doing a great job. They are looking over all procedures for how we bring faculty in to teach our ROTC students, and reviewing with academic HR policies, titles, et cetera, really doing hard work. And so that's just examples of what we'll be doing. Next slide, please. Additional topics, fun. We're going to start the conversation today on generative artificial intelligence, AI. There are many AIs here. We're also going to be trying to create a one Cornell, a one system-wide sense of what academic integrity is at Cornell, how we report it, and how we streamline it so that people actually pursue violations. I have learned by bringing the chairs and reporters together every semester, we're learning that there's a lot of faculty pulling away from actually giving an opportunity for students to learn about academic integrity and why their choices may not have been a wise one when they violate our procedures. So that is a very big job that we're doing, and we're trying to break it down by first taking feedback from all the chairs and reporters and trying to make a common system. But also we're creating a pilot system for the College of Computing and Information Sciences. Right now they don't have one. And so they've been piggybacking off the infrastructure from all the colleges that feed into CIS. So they're building their own. And they're building an interface that we can hopefully all benefit from. So they're going to be piloting some of the work that we've been thinking about. We're pulling in the retired faculty. We're having them work with us. We're hoping with the University Awards Committee that we ultimately create, writing op-eds, working on research integrity and IOCOOC, IRB, and I've spoken with the academics and professors emeriti, and they're really enthusiastic about bringing their expertise to these issues. Freedom of expression. Our group is going to volunteer, all of faculty, hopefully. We're going to do a collaboration with University Library on banned books, and I'm hoping that we can get enough faculty volunteers to read from the banned books. And so hopefully that will come together over the next semester, and then it will be an event in the spring. And then the last thing I have is I was asked if I would consider doing the last 2 years of a 5-year term by the UFC. He said yes. The UFC approved that, then went to the president and the provost, asked them what they think of it. They approved that. So I'm here today to ask if you will approve it. And so I'm going to use the Q&A. Okay, first, we have a motion from the floor. Well, thank you, guys. So I have a motion and a second. Yay. I just wanted to use the Q&A as an opportunity for people to ask me questions so that you can make a decision for yourselves whether I'm doing a competent job or not, and then I'll walk out the room while the vote is going on. And I am totally fine with either outcome. So if it's a yes, yay, I'll continue the work. There's a lot to do. If not, if it's a no, then I have to start planning for the next person and building a really kick-ass ballot. So that's my job. So I'll open it up to Q&A.
So this counts as as debating the motion.
Oh.
Just to make it official. And I'm not seeing any hands up in Zoom. If you have a question, can you come out to the microphone?
Okay. My preference is yes. Yes, I feel like there's a lot of work to do, especially with the academic integrity. There's just, it's a mess, I've learned. And so I see a lot of places where we can make improvements and also learning opportunities for our students. So, yeah.
So perhaps we should move right to the vote. And this is more complicated with people in Zoom and people in person. So I think I turn this over to Jill, perhaps. Okay, if you didn't hear that, there will be a poll for the that will be launched for the people in Zoom land. And this will be, I think, a more conventional
and I will do a count.
Vote by counting hands.
Okay, and you will verify my count so that I'm not.
And there is a quorum.
We do have quorum, so we'll go ahead and vote. Jill is going to be counting the votes that are online, and I will count the votes with Jonathan's backing so that it's clear that it's been seen by two people. So, and I believe I will refer to you, but I can just ask, so a vote of the yay, a vote of any nay, and any abstains, and I will count after each one. So could I get all hands raised and a vote of yay for having extension of Eve DeRosa's term for the final 2 years? I'm sorry? Yes, yeah, so this is Senate, so you have to be a member of the Senate that votes. I will actually get, I don't know if I need to get a full count of the room. We have, if, as long as you've signed in and you're a Senate member, then we have the full count of the room, so please, sorry for keeping your hands up so long, but please make sure you have signed in so that that is what I'm going to use to get the total count of people here. So again, can I get the yays raised hands?
Keep them raised.
Keep them raised. 31.
Okay. I had 30 my first count, so let's make it 31.
There's a couple of hands over here that you have to move around to like to
yeah,
see that. All. I was
going
to have them count off, but then I thought that sounded very kindergarten-y. Okay, any nays? Okay, and any abstains?
One and then zero.
Are you an abstain?
I am.
Okay.
Yes, okay,
so
perfect. Okay, so we're getting the online counts right now, so I can say.
So the total is 7 yeses, 5 twos.
Is that including the ones in the room? You've done the math that quickly. Okay, so the vote passes with 73 yes, 5 no, and 2 abstains. Thank you, everyone. Can I bring Eve back?
Yeah, and ask her if she has. She says still has. 7 minutes if she wants to keep talking. Ask her if she's done.
I think she'll probably be done. Thank
you. Thank you for your support. I really appreciate it. I'm learning a lot, and I'm really excited about finishing up sort of projects I had in mind. So thank you. We have 4 more minutes, I think, or 5 more minutes, if there are other questions. If not, I'll give a little context then. So Kate Supon is the community relations liaison from communications and university relations. And she and I were together last week or 2 weeks ago at a university assembly event, and she mentioned that she goes to every assembly and shares an economic snapshot, and she doesn't come to the Senate, and that seemed outrageous. So Kate's going to come and give us last year's economic snapshot. She does them every spring, and then she'll come back and see us again in the spring. So Kate, you want to come up? And thank you.
You want to use this podium here?
Yeah.
Okay.
No telling what I'll drop. Okay. So thanks for having me. As Eve said, I'm Kate Suffron, and I work in the Cornell Office of Community Relations, which is on the non-academic side of things here at Cornell. We are a small unit within the Division of University Relations that's headed by Joel Molina. Let's see, I guess we could go to next slide. All right, this is a shot of our website. You can find it at communityrelations.cornell.edu. It has some of the resources and information that I'll be talking about today. I'm really here to talk about the snapshot, but to give you the context, probably more of you are familiar with our offices in government relations in Albany and DC. We do the same thing here, but on a local scale. So we work with the 16 local municipalities in Tompkins County, a little bit with surrounding municipalities, with businesses, community organizations, nonprofits, and we help make connections on campus. We don't run our own engagement programs necessarily. We have programs that acknowledge and recognize different types of partnerships, but we connect folks on the outside to people on the inside and vice versa. We're not doing student engagement, but if someone asked us about that, we would know who to introduce them to on campus. We're more involved in nuts and bolts like sewer connections and recycling fees and a lot of really exciting things. So let me see where I am now. All right. Could you go forward 3 slides? I meant to reorder these. You all are getting a slightly older presentation. So each year we do a 1-page local economic snapshot. It is not economic impact. Cornell used to do every few years they would do a economic impact report. It was a little book. It took a long time to produce. It was expensive, and by the time it came out, the data was dated. And since it was expensive, it only happened every once in a while. And that was done by Professor Kieran Donaghy in the Department of City and Regional Planning. Once that was coming to the end of its time, our office, John Gutenberger was in charge at the time, or took this on as his project. I think he was no longer the director, but he said, hey, I think we could do this in 1 page, which is good because I know all of you and your students read everything that comes your way. I find most people don't read anything. So the shorter you can make something, the better it is. So we started putting together a bullet-pointed list of big buckets of Cornell's activity in the local economy. We aren't running raw spend numbers through the 348 formulas for economic impact. That's not what this is about. So it's pretty simple. Our key stakeholders, got that up there. You can see our offices in Albany and DC use this a lot to show the impact that Cornell has in our local economy. It goes out through CREA, through the assemblies, through ComNet, and externally we share it with municipalities, nonprofits, and businesses. So then back 1 slide. I'm making it tricky. Oh, let's see. Sure. So can you all, I'm guessing this never really works because it is so tiny. It is available on both our website and cornell.edu. And because I know from previous presentations that it's hard to read, I do have some hard copies that I could just sort of head back in the room. So I'll pass these.
When you pare it down, it's too much information to see on a single screen in a presentation. But what we have with the snapshot are really pretty sizable buckets that tell a little bit about the story of Cornell locally here in Ithaca. The numbers in this represent the Ithaca campus only. It does not include Agritech in Geneva. It doesn't encompass Cornell Tech in New York. And it certainly doesn't encompass the medical school. So it shows us we have 25,477 students in 2022. It's a really interesting number for the local community to wrap its head around. Always, the population in Cornell of Cornell students in the local community is in the low 20%. And you hear people say, oh, the students, they come, they go. They don't. They're always here. We're always going to have about 25,000 students in the community. So it's really important that they are seen and involved as part of the community, because it's a fundamental group. We have about just under 11,000 employees on the Cornell campus, working on the Cornell campus. About 73% of that 10,000 live in Tompkins County, and others in the percentages in the surrounding county. I think some of the most interesting numbers locally are student and visitor spending. They're also the least cut and dried to calculate. I do have a partner in this project who is Rod Court in the budget office, and he has worked under the tutelage of Professor Emeritus Donaghy to learn how to make these calculations. So I work with different units and community partners to gather the data, and then Rod can crunch out the numbers using Kieran's formula, and then Kieran checks our work to make sure that we're not, the main thing we don't want to do is overstate. So our calculations, the estimates that we use are conservative. Student spending is based on the number of students and where they live on versus off campus, and then there's a multiplier used for their expenses. It includes things like rent, food, entertainment, all kinds of spending, but that is a piece of the economy that folks forget about. 70% of our student body lives off campus in community housing, and so the property taxes that they pay through their rent are encompassed in the student spending number. Visitor spending, you can imagine, has been on a roller coaster ride for the past few years. It dropped from, let me see, the 2019 snapshot to the 2020 snapshot, so 4 months of the pandemic, it dropped by 60%, just from that little piece of it. Between the 2019, which was our last pre-COVID snapshot, and 2021, it dropped 99.5%. So that was a huge hit to the local economy. So it's rebounded. This is about 70% of what it was pre-pandemic for 2022, and we're hoping it'll be all the way back for 2023. I know all of you have heard Cornell doesn't pay taxes. Cornell doesn't pay taxes because, as we all know, it is a nonprofit, but we do pay taxes on our properties that do not have a primary educational purpose. At this point in time, Cornell is the second largest assessed value of taxable property in Tompkins County. So we are the second largest taxpayer overall when you look at the municipalities and the school districts that we pay taxes to, which surprises people. It is a drop in the bucket of what we would pay if we were taxable, but we're not. Let's see, we also make a lot of local contributions. The biggest chunk is to the city of Ithaca in a memorandum of understanding that is voluntary on both sides. Either side can, it is not a pilot agreement, which some people might have read in the local media lately. We do not have a pilot. But nobody ever checks with us before they publish things. So we don't have a pilot. We have a memorandum of understanding. We also give money to the Ithaca City School District is a large chunk. You might have seen Joel Molina came out and announced that we've extended our great agreement with the Ithaca City School District and increased the contribution from $500,000 to $650,000. Off the top of my head, using round numbers, we pay $1.9 million in property taxes on our taxable properties. And then there's another $1 million to Lansing, and it adds up to a little over $3 million in property taxes at this point, or property taxes paid to schools. So we do pay some taxes, but we make some voluntary contributions that are in the local contributions bucket. Running down there, the other piece, and I think I did property taxes out of order, municipal fees. A nonprofit is not exempt from municipal fees, so we pay the going rate for whatever the fee structures are. Water, sewer, stormwater, sidewalks, depending on the municipality,
are fee for service, so we are obligated to pay for those. I don't know if anyone walks in and comes across the pedestrian suspension bridge, that new sidewalk that's going on Forest Home Drive. It's in our sidewalk district. So that it's one of two really big sidewalk projects underway right now in the city of Ithaca in the vicinity of Cornell. And that one, because it is adjacent to campus, we pay for, not the city. So we do pay for our municipal services. Let's see. Boy, this is small. I made my copy even smaller. We calculate the research spending, research money that's spent locally. There's some possibility that there's a double count there because some of that is going to the salaries. You might have known the payroll for the Ithaca campus is $1.1 billion. We thought about, you know, there's no way to really extract and break that number down, but it is good for people to see the amount of money that is coming in from grants and research grants that is staying local. That is not the whole amount of grant income. It's just what is having a local spend. We also include the three different business incubators, REV that is downtown, Life Sciences and Life Sciences and Praxis on campus. Last year was the first year we could include Praxis because prior to that they couldn't break down their revenue to a local level or the income and jobs to a local level. I could keep going, but I'm trying to finish within time and leave folks time for questions. What people really like about this, so I think if we go forward a couple of slides, let's see, it may just be one. Oh, yep. There we go. The value of the snapshot. It comes out every year. It's reliable. It's dependable. It's easy to read. You can find it on cornell.edu. It's a nice animated version put up by the good folks in Brand. And you can find previous year snapshots by searching local economic snapshot and the year. It doesn't all come up at once, but you can. Folks always want to make comparisons, and we don't make that easy, but the information is there. So it's anticipated. It's straightforward. It has some good data in it, and yeah, I think that wraps it up on the snapshot. So thank you for having me come and take some of your time today. I know you're really focused on more academic pursuits, but there has been a lot of information recently and a lot of community discussion about what Cornell's contributions are to the economy or to the local economy and local community. We all know that that goes well beyond the financial, but this is an economic snapshot, so it focuses on the economic side. I can break down any of these numbers for you, if not here, in another situation. I do have the breakdown open on my screen, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
We have about 2 minutes if anyone wants to pose a question.
Yes.
If you're here and want a question, step down to the mic. If you're in Zoom, raise your digital hand. I think we have a question down here. Identify yourself.
Buzz Bostow, Faculty Senator for Biological and Environmental Engineering. Okay, I really enjoyed hearing this. I was actually thinking to myself, I would love to know, you know, what Cornell does with its revenue a couple of days ago, and I'm so glad I showed up for this.
There you go.
Sort of a follow-up question. I love seeing these numbers. I think this is fantastic. And Eve, thank you for bringing Kate in as well to do this. A question for you. Do we also have data on what Cornell does internally with its revenue? Sort of how does it spend all the money it raises? And how does that align with its stated goals and values?
So, interestingly, I also, in addition to, as my, you know, part of my gig in community relations, I am used to be the university relations representative. We realized that there were administrative units who had no representation on the employee assembly, so now I represent the employees in the central administration unit. So I sit on the employee assembly, and I am the operations vice or chair, I don't, VP, something like that. One of the things that we found really beneficial is inviting someone from finance. Last year it was Laura Sire, it used to be Paul Streeter, sometimes it's been Joanne DiStefano, to come in and do a presentation to the employee assembly on the Cornell budget model. And so they take the budget, they put it up there, and they explain it for you. There isn't something that's publicly accessible that does that, but you can, it's a great way to understand Cornell's budget model. It had been done for the local community when I was, I used to be a local elected official, and I got invited to a presentation by Joanne DiStefano to explain the budget model. And I, and the budgeting, and I walked away from it really enlightened, thinking, oh, I get it. Cornell's just broke on a bigger level. You know, I mean, everybody's budget, as you know, nobody has a giant pot of money anywhere that I found at Cornell. And yet to the outside, to our communities, it looks like we do. And it may look like that from one department to another. So it is a really, it is really interesting to work to understand that budget model and to explain to folks what the endowment is and what it can be spent for. Because the, you know, as we all know, it doesn't all go for sewer connections. Yep.
And Liz, we have the Financial Policies Committee, and they interact quite frequently with the central administration, and they write an annual report. So you can also look there. It's posted publicly.
Oh good.
It's posted publicly. See, I was wrong. All right. Anyone else have a question? I know I'm probably over time. Oh, two online.
Well, if there are no objections, I think we can take another couple of minutes because we have no good of the order today, but no more than a couple of minutes. So why don't we make them short if you can. Denise Ramsey.
Thanks. I just have a quick question. I recently read that negotiations between the city and Cornell had broke over the contribution we make in lieu of property taxes had broken down. And I was just curious if you could comment on that or if that was also inaccurate.
I would not say that there are negotiations underway. The current MOU expires in 2024. So we have made our payment to the city of Ithaca for this fiscal year. And then we will make it for the next fiscal year. But we're, for some time, have been working with the city to renegotiate that. I would not say that the negotiations have broken down. Cornell is not commenting in the media on the negotiations and how things are going. Some folks from the city are. But there are still active communications underway between Cornell and a negotiations team representing the city of Ithaca that's comprised of common council members.
Question in person.
Tom Fox, Molecular Biology and Genetics. It's idle curiosity, but if we're the second largest taxpayer in the county, who's the first? BorgWarner?
Anyone want to guess?
I'll guess BorgWarner.
No. NYSEG is the largest. And it used to be, we've moved up through the rankings even in recent years. And sadly, it's not because we're generating more in taxes, although we are, and for some reasons, but because some employers, like the power plant, used to be one of the big tax generators, and they're no longer near the top of the list.
Okay, one quick question from Richard Bensel, and then we need to move on.
Yeah, Richard Bensel, government. My question is, do you do the same kind of analysis and reporting for Cornell Tech in New York City as you do for Ithaca?
They have their own community relations teams in New York City. We do interface with their teams, but we don't do their analysis. And I don't think that we do an economic impact or an economic snapshot for those campuses. There are regular meetings on New York City government and community relations where all the sort of public relations folks from the different units that are in New York City and in Ithaca and in Cornell and Albany or Cornell and DC meet with Joel and discuss issues. But no, they're beyond our purview.
Okay, one short additional question and then we really will move on.
Yes, this admittedly is not a question, it's a statement. So I'm Russell Rickford from History. It's my very first meeting, so I don't know if there's another opportunity to engage in this kind of exchange. So I did briefly want to raise the question of the Make Cornell Pay Coalition with the goal of raising support among faculty senators. The Make Cornell Pay Coalition seeks a much larger payment in lieu of taxes agreement between Cornell and Ithaca. The premise of Make Cornell Pay is that Cornell is a tax evading billionaire that does not currently provide fair or adequate support for essential public services in Ithaca and Tompkins County. The memorandum of understanding between Cornell and the city expires next summer. After 21 years, and this offers an opportunity to pressure Cornell to honor its responsibility to help support the public good here in the local community. May Cornell Pay would like faculty senators to join the coalition. We're asking for you to visit www.makecornellpay.org to get more information. This is a growing movement. With a fraction of a percent of Cornell's billions, our local community could meet the deep need for free and accessible public transportation, thriving public schools, affordable housing, and better infrastructure. May Cornell's Pay proposal for a new memorandum of understanding would also create jobs, increase salaries for essential public workers, and accelerate the transition to green technology. This is an opportunity to build real solidarity with our neighbors. It's also a demand for real profit sharing, which is a fundamental question of democracy in our society. Ithaca will always be a company town, but we have a responsibility to see that it becomes a much more equitable place. Once again, please visit www.makecornellpay.org.
4:09 p.m.
Thank you.
I won't get into that, but I will say that I think it's the data is really important. And when there is a conflict, it is important first and foremost to have the data be clear and agreed to on what the picture is. If you have questions on Cornell's contributions or Cornell's numbers, our office can provide them for you. If you want to know how TEAC gets funded, if you want to know how the school system gets its money from Cornell, I'm happy to engage with any of you and share that information. But I do think the data sharing and agreement on what the numbers are is a critical first step in moving forward. So, because it's tremendously complex. Someone had read that same article in the Ithaca Voice, and a friend of mine called me the other night, and I spent an hour and a half on the phone with her answering questions that were all, you know, it's all public stuff, but how does this happen, and how does this happen, and where does that money come from? So, and she's been here since 1974, so it is a super complex picture, and we are happy to help folks unravel that. Thank you so much for having me and for sharing a little bit of extra time.
Thank you. We're moving on to the next agenda item, new generative artificial intelligence resource from the Generative Artificial Intelligence for Education and Pedagogy University Committee, presentation by Stephen Jackson, Vice Provost for Academic Innovation, Science and Technology Studies, and Rob Vanderlyn, Center for Teaching Innovation. Go ahead.
Great, thank you, and thank you all for giving us a few minutes to talk about this. It's not the last we're going to talk about. This is probably not the first you've thought about this or talked about this fall. I'll take a minute to introduce myself. I'm Steve Jackson. I'm new in this role, the Vice Provost for Academic Innovation. I'm a faculty member in Information Science and Science and Technology Studies, and I remain a faculty member. I'm 50% in that role, 50% in the VP role. So I'm going to say a few things to sort of talk about this fast-moving area that we're all encountering in our teaching. This is specific to teaching. I'll say a little bit about where we're at on this evolving question, what the university has come up with so far. And then Rob's going to share some of the great work and resources that have been made available through CTI. And this is one of many conversations we're having this fall, and I hope many more conversations with all of you. And then we want to leave time for questions and discussion, which is, in fact, the most important part. So next slide, I guess. So I'm going to share some highlights from a report you may have encountered. We've publicized this. This is the report of the Generative AI for Education and Pedagogy Working Group. I want to credit all the people that worked on this. There was a lot of people that put a lot of work into this. This report was issued in about the middle of August this year. It was one of the first of its kind. There were many universities who have been pointing to it, who have been drawing on it, and now coming up with their own resources as well. So as you can imagine, many campuses are trying to figure out how to tackle this problem this fall. Great representation across colleges, across areas, across teaching types, which is really important, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Next slide, please. So if you were hoping for a single answer, Cornell says, thou shalt do this, you will be somewhat disappointed. The whole ethos of the report, I would say, is the importance of tailoring to the specificities of learning objectives, course types, and instructor preference. So there is not a blanket university policy. We can talk, there are recommendations, we'll talk about that a bit more. To call out one feature of the report that I think is very useful, and a lot of other folks have been pointing to, for those of you who are relatively new to the generative AI space, I think the report has a really nice, circa August 2023, I should say, 6 months from now, this may already be a little bit outdated, but a very nice account that reviews some of the main tools out there. So the ones that the one that people may be thinking the most about at the moment is ChatGPT. Those of you who work in language and writing, that's probably the one you're encountering. There are versions of generative AI that apply to other kinds of medium, from image generation to sound and music generation to coding, auto generation of code. So there's a lot of different things going on. One other point to note out actually is that when we think about ChatGPT tools, we often think of the named generative AI tools. We often think of the named generative AI tools. Increasingly, what we are seeing and what we will see, we believe, in the years to come, is much of the software we use in an ordinary sense will be drawing on and drawing in generative AI. So important to note that as well. Next slide, please. Okay, so one of the things that I really like about the report, I should say I was not on the working group, so I encountered this when it was complete, is that it's relatively agnostic and even-handed about the range of responses that faculty might bring to this question. So one response that, depending on the course type and the learning objectives, may be absolutely the best stance for an individual faculty member is to prohibit the uses of generative AI tools in their particular classroom or for particular assignments. Now, I've added a little bit. This actually isn't in the report, but I'm saying prohibit, but I added a steer around, right? Because I think it's not enough to say, don't do it, right? If you put some threatening language in your syllabus and then thinking that's going to be effective. It needs to be effective prohibition, which might also involve different strategies of not steering into the worst potentials of generative AI. We can talk a little bit about that more in a minute. A second category is use with attribution, kind of like we think of other contexts of use of academic sources. If students are using it, we may allow that, but we want to make sure they're crediting that or acknowledging that when they do. And the third one is some category of creative engagement and sort of responsible use. So if you go through the report, you will see examples of each of these. I encourage you to do that. And if you go and talk with some of the people at CTI, Rob will share some resources in a minute too. You will also hear more examples of each of these conditions. Next slide, please. The other thing I'll call out is a very useful set of field-specific examples and sections. So each of us may have a particular concern around generative AI as it impacts our teaching. Those concerns are different by different field and area. So in some ways, this is said with some chagrin, I guess, but generative AI is an equal opportunity disruptor. It challenges many of our teaching practices across many of our disciplines at the same time. So the report spends some time talking about what generative AI might mean if you're teaching a writing seminar, what it might mean if you're trying to teach intro programming, what it might mean if you're teaching in the music and art space. So different people will be interested in different aspects of this, but I think it's worth taking a look at. Next slide, please. Okay, so a few meta points to summarize coming out of the report. Oh, I guess these are bullets. Importance of course and instructor-specific choice and preference, as I've talked about. Next bullet, please. This is a really important point we were trying to emphasize as syllabi went out this fall. It is very important that all teachers at the university clearly communicate what their policy or what their stance is in AI at the class level, like at the course level, or maybe at the assignment level. So in your course, you may be perfectly fine for students to use generative AI for some things, and you really don't want them to use it for others. Students are going to be encountering a wide range of conditions across the university this fall in particular. So being as explicit as you can about your expectations, again, at the course level or the assignment level is really important. I hate to sort of throw water on hopes, but one of the things that the committee spent some time on is reviewing the available detection tools and very wisely, I think, made the assessment that none of the available tools are up to the task of actually effectively identifying when generative AI has been involved. Rife with false negatives, rife with false positives, barely above chance, not at all the kinds of tools we can actually use to make tough and complicated academic integrity kinds of questions. Next slide, I guess. This is another point. Instructors may choose to start using generative AI in their own work, and if they do, we would like them to follow the same procedures that we've identified in the site, you know, the credit the work, right? If you decide you're going to use generative AI to help kind of help generate like a template slide deck on some area that you're going to then modify, you should be transparent to students about that, right? Same expectation we have of them in transparency, we should be exercising vis-a-vis them. I would really encourage you to keep your eye out for pro-learning, the uses of generative AI that we think are actually, in fact, pro-learning. Students will be using these in many ways, some ways that you may find problematic, some other ways that are actually really creative, and maybe things that you think, actually, that really augments the learning objectives in my class. I'm really glad the students are doing that. I think we can learn a lot from our students around uses like that if we pay attention. So I'd encourage you to talk to your students about that and keep an eye out for it. Next slide. If you are adopting, I'm hoping many of you are aware of the presence of bias and problems in these tools and inequalities of access, right? So different students may be using tools in different ways. There may be inequalities in the ways they have access to those tools. We can talk at great length about the problems of bias in these tools, but they are there, in addition to just errors, right? There's a lot of attention being given right now to like clearly false information that these tools are generating. More pernicious for me are the sort of the subtle patterns of bias that are also experienced in these. Don't enter things into generative AI that you don't want to put into the model database. Anytime you do a search, that's part of the corpus of future searches. So I think this should be obvious, but anything that's FERPA, HIPAA, personnel related, sensitive in any way, if you don't want future large language models or other kinds of generative AI tools to then be vacuuming that up and then deploying it out to others, don't enter it. And just as a note, this report has been centered on generative AI in teaching. There are separate processes underway at the university around research and administration, and so you'll be hearing more about those, I believe, later this fall. So I'll turn things over to Rob.
And just let me to let you know, we're already into the Q&A portion, so I'll try to keep it brief.
I'll be super brief. Thank you, Steve, for that summary. I just want to share the resources that the Center for Teaching Innovation have been working on ever since last November to try to help faculty figure out their stance and what they want to do and how they want to adjust. So we're running workshops that we ran initially in August. We're rerunning in September. The dates are up there. These slides will be shared, all the links. You'll be able to click right through to the registration, for example. If you need something before then, there are recordings of those previous workshops that are up as well. We've also created web resources that we're actually quite proud of, pages on academic integrity, on accessibility, on assignment design, which includes a lot of sample language you can use in your syllabus and with your assignments for whatever sort of stance you want to take, and then ethical concerns. All of these are resources that are being updated dynamically to improve them. We also have a blog where we'll be sharing examples of your colleagues creatively adapting in whatever shape they do to generative AI. Two more things. Every day CTI runs Zoom drop-in hours. You can just stop in, bring an assignment, bring questions, bring concerns. It can be very particular. It can be, I'm curious, show me what ChatGPT can do. We're happy to work with you directly, and we're prepared for that. And then we are also doing meetings with various departments that are inviting us in to do a department-wide conversation. It can be a half hour, 45 minutes, whatever you have. Talk a little bit about it, answer questions. And with that, I'll get out of the way and answer any questions we can.
Great. As usual, step up to the mic if you're in person and raise your digital hand if you're in Zoom.
Can I maybe do one shout out on the slide here?
Yeah, go ahead.
We, in addition to just now, we really want to hear the experiences. I think it's going to be essential that we gather the experiences from this fall effectively. I'm happy to be flooded with email at the VPAI address, sharing anything. It could be the good, the bad, and the ugly, the horror stories, here's this great idea, everything in between.
And I'd be happy for Steve to be flooded with email too, but you can also send it to me.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Buzz Bastow, Biological and Environmental Engineering. Thank you so much for that presentation. I thought it was wonderful, and I'm so glad that, you know, that you're tackling this issue. I was also really heartened to hear about your efforts in preparing reports on sort of administration and research as well. It's not really a question, it's more of a wish. I'd love to, you know, maybe in a future report to the Senate, to hear about, you know, how AI could, say, reduce the sort of administrative burden on the faculty and on the university. Like, how can we make it sort of fill out all those stupid forms for us? Like, how can we sort of allow it, how can it allow us to be sort of more creative, more human, and less a sort of a PDF form filling out robot?
As a fellow PDF form filling out robot, I hear you, and I totally love the sense of that question. We will be coming back, I think later, we need to talk more, but I think later in the semester even, I believe we'll be back. And I'm not sure about the exact timing of these other reports I've mentioned. I'm not involved in those reports, thankfully. But those will be coming back to faculty. And I do think that's a great example of, like, it's a complicated change. There's challenges involved. There are some real opportunities, and I think we can seize them, including to address real issues of faculty workload that and staff workload that we all struggle with. That would be great.
Thank you very much.
We have another in-person question, maybe the last.
Hi, I'm John Sipple, faculty senator from Global Development. Thanks so much for this, very helpful. It's maybe an impossible question, but can you give us some guidance or some sense of how rapidly this is developing, how quickly this is likely to change in terms of strengths and weaknesses and so forth? Is this month by month, year by year, decade by decade?
Certainly not decade by decade. It's at least year by year, and it's at least partly month by month, I would say. Even if you talk to experts in the AI field, including colleagues here at Cornell, I think there was a bit of a breakthrough that happened that we're really seeing reflected in the tools that are coming out around now in the last year. And that was faster than anyone had quite imagined, right? So what comes next is a bit hard to say. There's more and more investment going into this space. A lot of the tech firms are really redirecting all of their research efforts in this area. So I think what we should assume is a world of significant change and evolution, and pretty rapid change and evolution. That's part of the reason that the report circa 2023 is great, but it's going to be really important for us to gather our experiences and update, and we'll do our best to do that on the teaching side.
I also just say, in direct relevance to teaching, it is changing enough that I think on a semester-by-semester basis, you should sort of revisit it and see what it can do. I know faculty early on were like, they would check an assignment and go, oh, it's actually, that's like C-minus work, I'm not really worried. That may be very different the next time you teach that assignment. So I would say rapid.
We have a minute and a half, David.
David Delshamps, Electrical and Computer Engineering. I always thought it was kind of ironic that AI means artificial intelligence and academic integrity. But anyway, my question is the following. Like, having served on EPC and academic integrity hearing boards and stuff, contract cheating, where people pay for a fresh paper to be written about T.S. Eliot in the late 30s, you know, that can't be detected by Turnitin, okay? I don't know how much of that goes on at Cornell. I don't know whether we have data. I don't know whether you polled students and asked them. You know, I don't know that kind of thing. This kind of strikes me a little bit like equal opportunity contract cheating. Mm. Kids who couldn't afford to pay the paper mills can now get one for free. Now, is that something that has occurred to people or whatever? The equitable kind of paper?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that there is maybe a leveling quality that, I think that the nature of academic integrity and violations of academic integrity, I don't think we've had a good handle on in its historical form. And there have been deep inequities in the way that's been managed. That is one, if you want a silver lining or positive element to this, I guess, if you want to call it out. Rob?
Can I just say also, though, I think it's important to recognize that there was obviously, understandably, a lot of faculty anxiety about what this would mean for academic integrity. There's also a ton of student anxiety about what generative AI and this whole AI moment means for them. Have they been studying the last 4 years a set of skills that are no longer as relevant as they once were? And I also think we've talked to a lot of students in the last year. A lot of them are thinking about this, like, how do I continue to demonstrate what I can do that a machine can't do? So I think we have to focus on academic integrity, but I think there's a lot more at stake in these questions as well.
Maybe just one very quick, that last question you asked was about, do we have data internally on what the answer is no, not at Cornell. There is a really interesting study it's not quite a study. A survey was run by the Stanford newspaper in last spring, and they did an anonymous survey of students and their use of generative AI. And one of the striking things, this connects to the pro-learning uses of it, that struck me is only something like, this was self-reported, but it was anonymous, only something like 7% looked like what you would think of as straight up cheating, right? Like I got AI to ChatGPT to generate an essay for me, and I wrote my name on it and I handed it in. A lot of it was, there were students who were using it to overcome language barriers. There were students who were using it to like help process lectures that they didn't really understand and form outlines that were more useful for studying. There were students using it in a collaborative way. So I don't want to put too sunny a point on it, but the range of uses to get to the nature of the report were really quite varied. And I suspect, without knowing, that we would see a very similar distribution or pattern of uses among students here at Cornell. Another good reason to talk to your students about it as openly as you can and convey to them, if you feel it's not appropriate to use, why it's not appropriate to use, right? Remind them that education is not transactional, although sometimes they believe it is. Remind them that you're here to learn something and this is hurting your learning, right, if that's the stance you need to take.
Okay, we really need to move on. No, I'm sorry.
Happy to chat more later.
Yeah, it's an amazingly important area of discussion. We're going to continue with a discussion about establishing a teaching professor track in Cornell Bowers College of Computing and Information Science, CIS. I believe we're starting with Charlie Van Loan, and then we will go to Michael Ryan Clarkson. And is Charlie on Zoom?
Yeah. So why don't you go can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I'll start out by saying a few things and then hand it over to Michael, who's in the room. And just a little bit of a clarification. This is not something just for CIS. This is something we're thinking about adding a title to the university's list of approved titles. I want to thank Eve and the UFC for giving us a chance to say a few things so early in the academic year. Next. The goal, what we want to do is educate as many people as possible, Senate committees and other interested parties, about the need to having a three-tiered teaching professor track. Okay, we're hungry for ideas. All we're doing here is setting the stage for productive discussion. This is not a pre-resolution, a tentative resolution, or anything like that. It's simply get these ideas out there and find out what the campus thinks. Next. There are three supporting documents. They're all online. The slides are basically a distillation of the first basic document. And then there's a lot of background. I went through all the Senate archives, pulling out key ideas from our many, many discussions that relate to teaching-related titles, okay? And that goes back 50 years. Michael has surveyed numerous peer institutions. Again, not to be copycat, but to look for ideas. And he'll speak more about that later. Next. The starting point is two-tiered tracks. I want to thank Patty Yard in the provost office and Jill Short in the dean of faculty office for leading me to the literature back in the early 70s when we established the lecturer track. At that time, there were plenty of lectures around. The addition of senior lectures happened at that time. and the track came into existence. It was patterned after two other existing tracks, the Research Associate track and the Extension Associate track. Last year, as you recall, when we were talking about research titles, the Research Associate track came up. And so we're no stranger to this. Next slide. It has shortfalls. We'll mention three. First, it reflects a lesser view of teaching when you compare it to the clinical professor and professor of the practice tracks. Then, it hinders recruitment of the best educators. The recruitment angle came up when we did professor of the practice, clinical professor, and research professor. Many of the absence, you know, the title, it hurts us, okay? Other schools have professorial teaching titles, and it's hard to compete with them. Finally, it sends a negative message to students, parents, and alumni. Next. Okay. I have two data slides just to give you a snapshot of the scope of RTE teaching. These are the RTE teaching titles, okay? And you can see their numbers. We're primarily interested in the lecturers, but there are other titles whose primary objective is teaching. POP and clinical are specialized teaching, and we have, you know, and many colleges now offer those types of appointments. For your information, there are about 1,600 tenure track faculty. That number has stayed fixed over decades. Next slide. There are all kinds of trends out there. This window from 2014 to 2022 was just a handy window. When you go online to the Institute for Institutional Planning and Research, they have all the data, and it spans those years. Let's look at some numbers. North Campus housing, we as a result, the undergrad population increased by 9%. Big growth in professional master's programs. Graduate students, these are the PhDs, 41% increase. When you look at the numbers of RTE teaching faculty, those are title holders of the slides previous, on the previous slide, that too has grown. And as I mentioned, the tenure track faculty numbers have stayed basically flat. It's sort of plus or minus 25 each year. You can use 1600 as a good base number. Next slide, please. So all these things point to the increased reliance on RTE teaching. It's important. Let's elevate the status of teaching on our campus. So the idea in a three-tiered track is just like in the tenure track, assistant, associate, full. You have to figure out job descriptions. You have to figure out promotions. You have to think about side effects and whether such a development like this would strengthen Cornell. That's what we're asking. That's what we're trying to find out. And we need feedback all across the from all types of faculty, colleges, and departments. Next slide, please. We might want to compare or think about the other RTE professorial tracks and how they impact students. The clinical professors is very big in the law and vet. It advances clinical education. Okay. In engineering and other colleges, POPs advance practical education. I know we don't think of our research professors as being a teaching title. However, they certainly have a positive impact on the PhD culture and PhD related education. What's missing? What's missing is a three-tiered title track that advances undergraduate education. Next slide. We all know from hanging around the Senate, we've have these proposals that come from the colleges. They are authorized by the Senate. There is something called enabling legislation. It outlines the form of a proposal that a college must submit to the Senate for approval. In that proposal, you do such things as justify the need for the appointment, talk about hiring, reappointment, and promotion, talk about percent limitation, other connections to the tenure track and other tracks out there. So that's a methodology for approving this. And we recommend that this be used should we form a teaching professor track. There are two fringe benefits for doing this. First of all, it forces the unit to think hard about what they're doing, okay? And second, we have, as Michael will elaborate, big time issues and questions that relate to the current lecturer track. Well, you can't put together that three-tier track without thinking hard about the lecture track and our current pool of 300 plus lecturers on campus. It's well known that there are issues and unevenness across the colleges when it comes to the lecturer track. And again, the act of putting together a three-tier track, which may involve lecturers in various ways, would be healthy for dealing with those issues. There are, and we collected them. Every college has a document about lecturers. We looked at that and we reported on that in our document. Last slide for me before I hand it over to Michael. Again, the CP and PLP and RP tracks were relatively easy in a certain sense because they started from scratch, okay? We have here, again, on campus, hundreds of lecturers. And so some of the challenges confronting us now would be how to relate this track to the current pool of lecturers. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Michael, who's in the room, and we'll talk about the various ways we can do that.
Thank you, Charlie. Next slide, please. So it will help me organize these remarks if we distinguish the lecturer track not in two ways, but in three. Think of senior lecturers in two different ways: senior lecturers who have been first appointed to that rank, and then senior lecturers who at some point have gone through a reappointment process to that rank. Next slide, please. Okay, so Charlie and I have been trying to brainstorm ideas. We've been talking with other people around campus, like associate deans, the RTE working group, some of you folks. We've also looked carefully at what our peers do, again, as Charlie said, not to try to copycat them, but to try to be aware of some of the best thinking about this out there and see what works best for us at Cornell. We've identified three dominant options that exist elsewhere and that could make sense here. Those are coexistence, replacement, and merger. Next slide, please. So in the coexistence option, the lecturer track remains, and a teaching professor track is added in parallel with it. There's lots of questions that we need help answering here to instantiate this kind of model if it's something we want to pursue. What are the job descriptions in the lecturer track and the teaching professor track? How do they differ? How do they have to change for what exists for lecturer? And in particular, if we could go to the next slide, please. What is the distinction between those two tracks? That's the core question as part of this option. I can tell you from looking at what our peers have done that the main distinction that's drawn is something like this at every one of them that has done this option. They distinguish the teaching professor track by making it somehow be the more full incarnation of a professorial level of teaching. So some things that can involve are service, impact not just on courses in the department, but across a university or even externally in the world, which could be through things like pedagogy, textbooks, and many other kinds of contributions to professional educational societies. Lecturers in this model typically are some lesser form of incarnation of teaching, something that relates to specific jobs of just teaching specific classes and no expectation typically of impact beyond that class taught. Next slide, please. The replacement option is to introduce a teaching professor track and completely eliminate the lecturer track eventually. This is easier in some ways and harder in others. Can we get the next slide, please? Compare it to the coexistence model. Coexistence has some benefits. It lets you actually distinguish what are professorial levels of teaching, whatever that means in the local culture, from other kinds of teaching. It also gives units flexibility if they want to be able to hire into two different tracks and have different job expectations and promotion processes for those people. By the way, it is by far vanished, like the most dominant model of anyone out there doing this. Everyone more or less does the coexistence model. But I'm telling you about the others because it's important to consider other options. The replacement model is super easy to implement compared to the coexistence model because it means just transferring people over in titles. It doesn't require the hard, dare I say, intellectual work of teasing apart these two tracks. Next slide. Okay, the final option is merger. There's a lot of different versions of this. They all have the following flavor. Take some subset of these six titles and make a track out of them. The requirement is you have to have something from the lecturer track and something from the teaching professor track. So I'm not going to talk about all the different possibilities here. This is one important one to note, where you go lecturer, senior lecturer, full teaching professor, because it means just adding on one rank that doesn't currently exist here, and then you're done, in theory. If we could go to the next slide, here's another version of it where you go lecturer, associate, full. Next slide, please. You could have a four-rank track, lecturer, senior, associate, full. Yes, someone out there in the world does do that. We've seen evidence for that exactly once in our peer study. Next slide, please. Okay, so comparing these, actually merger is potentially, as I mentioned a second ago, the easiest to implement because it's just adding one more track if all you do is add the full teaching professor. But in all other ways that we've thought about carefully, it seems to be less suitable for us. It doesn't address retention concerns or recruitment concerns. And it creates real opportunities for confusion, both locally here on campus and when other people outside look at what our web pages say, what our titles say for our faculty. What does it mean when there's people that are both lecturers and professors in the same track? That's hard to explain. Next slide, please. Okay, so our study document, our main document that's up on the website for today's agenda, lays out a bunch of open questions that we need help answering. We would love to have some ideas from you. This is a subset of those questions, so feel free to go off and take a look at the rest of them. But we need to know more about what's the best option for us. If you did want to go with this dominant coexistence option, how are you going to write the job descriptions? How are we going to implement this? How would the transition be handled? There could be a lot of administrative overhead involved with some of these possibilities. And finally, what would you end up putting in the faculty handbook as the job descriptions for each of these? And then on top of that, what would the colleges do to refine that in their own particular contexts? Okay, next slide, please. And that's the end. We need feedback. We really welcome your feedback. Please post comments on the faculty website if you'd like to do that, or email us directly. Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for maybe one question. If you're here and have a question, I see no one here. Yeah, go ahead. And if it's short enough, we can go online for the last question.
Abby Cohn, faculty elected trustee. So I had a couple questions, but I had a very specific question. Having just glanced at the comparison report, at the University of Washington and at UCLA, I've had conversations with people very recently who have explicitly referenced their teaching tracks as tenure track. And I saw that there was some ambiguity around Washington, but I know actually a student of mine being recruited into such a track. So I think it's very important that we address that. And I saw in your review that very few places were doing that, but I think that has to be addressed a little more fully. And I guess I would be interested in us thinking about this sooner rather than later from a very pragmatic perspective, which is what are the teaching loads? What would we change what we're doing around sabbaticals? What are the salary scales? And to really think in a very nitty-gritty way about how it would work and maybe even go department to department to say, what would this look like, and gather that information together, and then based on what our kind of bottom-up grassroots needs are, think about how that fits in to the more conceptual and the comparative. So, thank you.
If I could just make a plug, indeed, if you want to know more about this, in the documents we posted, we do summarize what other schools do with respect to tenure and sabbaticals. And the answer is not everybody does it, definitely. Some of them do, but they never, never call it tenure, even if colloquially they call it that.
The thrust I'm getting from this presentation, which I think is very helpful, and this is clearly a very timely thing, is that de jure, it's not tenure. But if colloquially, that's the first thing I heard from my peers at these two other institutions, we have to engage and address with that at the colloquial level.
Thank you. We have a final agenda item, introduction of the new Dean of the Cornell School of Continuing Education. I'm going to screw up the name, but I'll try anyway. Why don't you introduce yourself, Mary?
Sure, thank you so much. I'm Mary Leffelholtz.
Okay.
Yes, German. Dean of the college, Dean of the School of Continuing Education since March 1st of this year, and also professor of English. I'm in the English department here. I'll say it's a thrill to join the English department. My area of study is American poetry, 19th century, early 20th century. It's a very distinguished department for that. It's been for a long time. Coming to the department of Jonathan Culler is amazing. And joining the intellectual community that brought to us a couple of weeks ago Andrew Piper's lecture, I think with the sponsorship, one of the university's faculty lecture, that was incredible, on computational humanities. I maintain a little bit of a visitor's interest in digital humanities. And if anyone out there is interested in doing for poetry what Piper is doing for fiction, I would love to know you and your graduate students. My main role here, though, is as Dean of the Cornell School of Continuing Education. And let me give you some next slides. Next slide. Information first about our ongoing programs. These are probably pretty familiar to you. We run the winter and summer sessions, and in the winter session, we have run about, in this last one, about 63 courses. These are 100% remote, whether they're online or they represent travel abroad educational programs. 2,521 total semester hour enrollments. The summer session is about five times as large. And it's a different mix. It's about 53% right now of our courses are online. And this is driven by faculty choice. Faculty indicate to us in what modality they want to teach when they propose courses for the summer. About 53% of the courses are online, 47% in person. The enrollment hours tilt more towards the online courses there. But a lot of that is explained by the presence of the pre-college students in the summer session courses. The pre-college program has been going on for a very long time. It was primarily residential until pretty recently. COVID, it brings high school students age 15 and up to the campus to take four credit courses, credit-bearing courses, which are transcripted, which they then take home with them. Again, been going on for a very long time. It went online during COVID, having reached a height of more than 2,000 students, residential students, in summer 2020, 2019, then returned briefly for a residential combined with online program in 2022. We had to interrupt that because the labor market for hiring people to look after those students in Ithaca post-COVID was very, very difficult, as those of you involved with Ithaca labor markets, community labor markets, doubtless know. So we went back online and were 100% online again this summer of 2023, again with good enrollments from about 1,300 students in total. But if you subtract those pre-college students from the overall enrollments in the summer session, you can see that they're the relationship between enrollments in online courses and in-person courses is pretty, the distributions follow pretty well. The students enroll, our matriculated Cornell undergraduate students elect to enroll across those courses in proportions pretty, you know, pretty close to the offerings. We also do, among other things, support for special programs that require registration of students who are not matriculated in one way or another. Some of the programs run by the Office of Global Learning, we assist with getting those students registered. We assist eCornell with their programs connected to the National Education Equity Lab, which offer online courses supported by Cornell undergraduate student mentors in Title I high schools around New York and around the region. So we help out in those respects as well. Next slide, please. What we're going to bring forward to the Faculty Senate this year is an initiative that started with a report that came to the Provost's office in the fall of 2021, a group co-chaired by Lisa Nishi and Avery August, that proposed that Cornell investigate offering a part-time online degree conferred through the School of Continuing Education for post-traditional students, and that would be students at least 4 years beyond their most recent experience of secondary education. These are just the recommendations that came through on this report issued in 2021. That report is still available in its entirety on the Provost's office if you want to Google that or to shoot me an email and I will send you the link to that. The fundamentals of this recommendation, this in order to work, in order to be effective and to be sustainable, this degree would have to offer a finite set of focused major options that are related to what Cornell does so well. The degree would combine elements of a liberal education with 21st century focused skills. It would be predominantly asynchronous in terms of its delivery, but have synchronous options that faculty members would offer to students. There would be faculty engagement in high quality academic and career advising. This would not be the close involvement and the continuing involvement of Cornell faculty members, not only in the design of the courses, but in their delivery is an important part of what we're designing for. In terms of the potential constituency for this degree, the report identified students graduating from our community college partners with an associate's degree through the Cornell Prison Education Program, CPEP. There are working adults all around this country, some 9 million of them, I want to say, in New York State itself, 40 million in the nation at large, who have some college credit but no degree, and who many of whom would like to complete their degrees. We have incarcerated individuals, active duty military personnel and veterans, indigenous communities around here. So this was the task we were given. Next slide. And what we want to bring forward before the Faculty Senate is a proposed curriculum for a Bachelor of Science with two majors, one in business, where I'm very, very delighted to say that the School of Business wants this to be a fully accredited AACSB accreditable business degree in which they are deeply involved. So that would be one major. Another major, a major in law, society, and policy with two professional tracks or concentrations within it, one in healthcare and the other in environmental sustainability. Two minors that would add value to the degree. We're also talking with the data science department about being a third major in the year after this. It's structured as a BS degree by NICED requirements, which means that about half of the degree's credits would be in liberal arts distribution areas, including a number of courses that would be very familiar to you in your own degree programs that would need to be taken at Cornell, including some first year writing programs, the new diversity course, some other courses that would be common experiences for students in the degree. Questions?
We do have a minute or two. Come on up if you're here and identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Tara Holm. Thank you for your presentation. I am the faculty senator from the math department. I have two questions for you. Well, one comment and one question. So first, I do strongly hope that you are bringing back in-person summer pre-college students. Students from Ithaca High School often take math classes and they really struggle to find excellent math opportunities, and at the moment particularly so because they cannot take SCE courses in person right now, and we only offer courses in person. That's related to my second comment. I think the one thing the math department learned during COVID was that we absolutely cannot assess students online. And so I'm curious to know more about how that would happen in the online part-time bachelor's degrees.
Sure.
In a minute.
Okay, I'm going to be really brief. To answer the first question, yes, there is going to be a residential program, we hope. We're working with a third-party provider to provide supervision, wraparound support services for the students in summer 2024. The deans were invited to invite faculty members to propose those programs. One didn't come forward from the math department. However, enabling local students to come to campus, students in high schools around Ithaca, enabling those students, minor students, to come to campus and enroll in our courses as they have in the past, we're going to be able to do. We're going to need the wonderful new Allison, I'm going to lose her last name, the wonderful new person responsible for minor safety on campus is thoroughly revising the university's cornucopia of policies and forms in such a way that parents will be able to sign an appropriate release and will train the faculty members so that those students can be in our classrooms going forward. And about the assessment, this is a wider conversation that I think it overlaps some with some of what Steve was talking about the brave new world of AI and so forth. And the first place to do it is with your colleagues who are teaching online. End of story.
Thank you. 5 o'clock. I respect all of your time. I know you're busy. So the meeting is adjourned.
Everyone, today's Chelsea's birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Chelsea. Happy birthday to you.
Yeah.